Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate you taking time to join us for the next hour. And if you're with that esteemed group of colleagues that are with us live, if you'd like, you could scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where you'll find a link for the chat room. That's a great place to go in if you have some observations you'd like to share during the course of the show, or if there's a question you would like for my co-host and I to eventually get around to, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show if you'd like to jump in there. Also, if you got to run off and take care of some business and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio after the show is completed, or just take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, and that way you can catch up at your leisure. And let's go ahead and dive into the show today. Today we're going to really cover the whole gambit, mile wide and an inch or two deep, so to speak, because when you look at the news of the last year, when it comes to naval developments, and we've touched on some of them here during previous shows. But Argentina's missing submarine has brought to the front a lot of issues that we want to talk about with regard to smaller navies and how they're trying to have that asset in their arsenal. They're just proliferating all over the place as technology and manufacturing capabilities are resident in more and more countries. We'll take a look at the Russian developments, European naval trends, and also some U.S. naval systems and how they play into how the environment and the terrain is changing globally with navies. And we have just the right person here today to talk to us, returning guest Eric Wertheim. Eric is well known to navalists out there, as not just as a defense consultant, columnist, and an author specializing in naval and aviation issues. Since 2002, he's taken the point on really the reference document for navalists. That's the U.S. Naval Institute's Combat Fleets of the World. He served as an advisor and a contributor on dozens of studies and reports conducted by the Department of Defense and NATO. From 94 to 2004, he wrote the bi-monthly Lest We Forget column on historic U.S. naval warships at the Naval Institute Proceedings magazines. He knows the D.C. area well as a good American University graduate. And since 2004, you can still find him in the monthly Combat Fleets column in Proceedings, in addition to his annual review of the Navy runs in the March issue of the magazine. He is a co-author with Norman Polmar of The Chronology of the Cold War at Sea and The Dictionary of Military Abbreviations, both of which are published by Naval Institute Press. Eric, welcome back to Midrats.
Great. Thanks for having me here. Always glad to be back.
Hey, and you've done some, and we're going to fold into this during the course of the show today, but I thought we'd kick off the show with something you've been investing a lot of your time in, and that has to do with the proliferation of submarines. But before we kind of broaden the net, you know, obviously the last month, the big news, there's a lot to draw from it from a variety of different angles. Is the tragic loss of the submarine navy, the Argentine naval submarine, the San Juan, and 44 of the sailors on board. And I thought what was interesting is over three decades ago, though it doesn't seem that long for some of us, that was one of the big takeaways, especially for the Argentinians, but for navies worldwide, is the power that just one difficult-to-find submarine can do. It really gave the Brits a lot of headaches, even though it wasn't really that combat effective if you're looking at putting holes at the bottom of the ocean. And after the Falklands, they had a really ambitious program working with the Germans plans to build a rather substantial subsurface fleet with the TR-1700 class, of which the San Juan was one. So I thought we'd kick off for a minute and, you know, inform the readers the San Juan. What was that submarine represented to Argentina? And what are some of the big lessons of that Argentine submarine program up to the loss?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a sad few weeks for the submarine community internationally because they are, in a way, a fraternity and a tight-knit group, all going through the same types of risks and dealing with the same kind of challenges. And it's an inherently dangerous business going under the sea in these steel boats, if you will. And the San Juan was the second of two TR-1700 class submarines that were built in the mid-80s for in Germany for Argentina. And they displace about 2,100 tons surfaced, about 2,400 tons when submerged. And they initially were very capable submarines. The challenge for Argentina, and this is a very big challenge we could discuss later for a lot of smaller navies, is submarines are inherently expensive and complex to operate. And we don't know exactly what went wrong in this situation, but we do know that that as budget cuts happen and budget shortages and other priorities come up, very often navies and submarine communities can get shortchanged in the budget fights. And when this happens, we know that there can be real implications for naval forces. And while we've seen this in Argentina and other South American countries, we've seen it happen, but on the side where things have been vessels have been sidelined and turned non-operational, but we haven't seen it to this degree where a submarine is lost. And my guess is it's very possible that it has something to do with the long-term effects of those kind of budget cuts.
Well, let's talk a little about might as well get into it, the proliferation of submarines. Every time I turn around, it seems that some country that I didn't think would have any reason to have submarines is looking to buy some, already has some, everything from kilos to some of the classes the Australians are currently looking at. What is driving this effort by so many countries to have a fairly robust submarine community?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And submarines are proliferating throughout the world, and it's based on a lot of issues. One of the biggest is one submarine can have a very profound effect on a fleet because you can't find it. They're very, very difficult to find submarines. So a small navy very often is attracted to that idea of being able to threaten a larger navy or any type of navy just by the mere presence of an idea of the submarine. And we saw that, of course, in the Falklands, where the Argentinian submarines were not as operational and as effective as they had hoped, yet they still had a dramatic effect on British submarine operations. Take that and compare that to what happened with the British submarine force, which, of course, sank the Belgrano, the cruiser Belgrano in 82 during the conflict, and also, in many ways, caused the Argentine fleet to stay much closer to port and make them severely reluctant to go out for risk of that they wouldn't be able to find these submarines, and they'd put the entire fleet at risk. So submarines and navies of the world took note of that, but only in the past decade has submarine technology and submarine prices become kind of met at a point where they're affordable now by much smaller navies. Of course, the challenge with that is these submarines have not gotten any simpler, so they're still very complex and maintenance intensive and inherently dangerous to operate. And these are one of the things. I think the loss of San Juan is a very important lesson for a lot of the smaller navies that are looking to invest in submarines, because they are really going to have to pay close attention to maintenance and training for these types of things.
Let's focus a little bit on one of those nations I think is intriguing. And that is Taiwan. Taiwan has, you know, obviously her big sister next door. She's kind of an international, I think pariah is too strong of a word. She's people like to pretend she's not there, but she's a very advanced country, a relatively rich country, but definitely has a need to recapitalize her submarine service to the point that because of the international restrictions from her being able to buy from somebody else, there's some discussions they may try to do it domestically. What do you think are some of the largest hurdles Taiwan would face trying to build her own submarines?
Yeah, absolutely. Historically, you know, they got a lot of aid from the West, but in the past generation, that's really dried up militarily. And so, of course, for listeners that don't remember, in 2001, President George W. Bush announced that the U.S. would provide 8 conventionally powered diesel subs for Tehran. But immediately, the governments in Netherlands, Australia, Germany, in order to appease China, declared that their submarine builders would not participate. Well, of course, the United States does not build diesel submarines and has not in decades. And so Taiwan is still without its submarines. And so their only option now at this point is to try and build them themselves if they want to maintain that capability. And I think that they're aware of how important, as we discussed before, submarines are when facing a far larger fleet, as Taiwan does with the People's Republic of China. And so with that situation, they are fully aware how important submarines are, and they can't get access to them in the West, so they feel they're going to have to build them. The challenges are the design, the development, the manufacture. Every step of the way, they're going to have severe challenges. Now, whether or not they can do this, at first, I'm skeptical. I will say that I'm skeptical, but if they put enough effort and energy into it and technology and invest in it heavily enough, I do think they'll be able to. How capable they'll be, we have yet to see. But, I mean, look, if North Korea can develop nuclear weapons and ICBMs and submarine-launched weapons, then, I mean, Taiwan is certainly capable of developing submarines. But it's not going to be an easy process for them, and I'm sure it's going to be quite a challenge technologically and industrially.
Well, that reminds me of another area that I keep. It seems that navies are also expanding in different ways. One of which is that they go from. There seems to be a push for missile boats or corvettes or frigates among some of the smaller navies. Is that a Am I seeing a trend there? And if so, why are they pursuing those types of vessels?
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing a proliferation all around the world in navies, a lot of it because of the global situation, what we see happening in the South China Sea, and we see tensions between China and Japan, and we see China going more into the Indian Ocean, reaching towards the Persian Gulf, these kind of things. Other navies are not used to operating with a potential threat on their borders, and they're looking and they're seeing this kind of spiral, not just because of China, but because of rivals and neighboring countries all being able to acquire this very, very advanced technology. And that advanced technology is mostly inherent on the surface in anti-ship missiles. We're seeing that a lot, the proliferation of a lot of these anti-ship missiles from Russian and Chinese navies, and they're very, very advanced. And they're very fast. Their ranges are getting longer and longer. And that's one of the major shortcomings that the West has faced in the past, is that while we were focused on the global war on terror between 2001 and maybe 2010 to 2014, you could say, Russia and China were focused on very heavily on building up their conventional military forces, and they've done so phenomenally well. Their forces have increased in capability, while ours were really conventionally at a standstill. our conventional forces. So, and we focused on the global war on terror. So now we have a lot of catching up to do. So their anti-ship missiles, for the most part, outrange ours until new weapons like LRASM, a long-range anti-ship missile, come in to service in the next decade. And there's numerous advances, though, that are coming to fruition now in the West, just starting to. NSM is a new missile that's coming out. The Poles have bought it from it's built and designed in Norway. Naval strike missile it is, and it's got some stealth characteristics. It's arguably better than Harpoon. It's got longer range, and then of course the Navy is adapting its Tomahawk cruise missiles to again turn them into anti-ship missiles, which is going to be a very powerful addition to warships and cruisers and destroyers in the U.S. fleet that then could be able to pack a punch with Tomahawks, whether it's for land or sea strike. But, of course, these smaller navies are seeing the capabilities that China and Russia have to offer, and they're gobbling them up. And we're seeing that with a lot of countries that are just investing heavily in smaller anti-ship missiles and small boats. And I'm not just talking about countries like Iran that's investing in swarm boats and missile boats, but I'm also talking about countries like Turkmenistan that has recently purchased guided missile patrol craft that are each armed with 16 SSN-25 Switchblade surface-to-surface missiles, anti-ship missiles. I mean, that's a lot for operations in the Caspian. We're seeing proliferation even among these smaller navies. I mean, the Turkmen Navy is probably less than 1,000 people. So it's interesting indications that we're seeing, and we're seeing it across the board. So we're seeing it in smaller navies like Turkmenistan and in the South China Sea, where their countries feel threatened, and we're seeing it in the proliferation in larger navies where they're using their technology to really beef up their capabilities.
I was thinking one of the more interesting developments, kind of a parallel to the old payloads over platforms marketing term. And that has to do, when you look at the Russian Navy, she has some legacy monsters left over from the Soviet Union. But when you look at her modern ship and her modern construction, one thing that really looks apparent is as these older Soviet platforms age out and fall off to the right, there really are no large warships to take her place. If the Russian Navy will morph into a corvette frigate navy with a large submarine component, but as I've shown in the Eastern Mediterranean and in the Caspian as well, their corvettes really pack a punch. Have you seen any indications that besides wanting to buy them, whether other navies are looking at that bang for the buck that the Russians have demonstrated over the last 2 years that might influence how they're going to shape their fleets?
Yes, I think that you're seeing kind of a mix. So you're seeing countries like China, which is trying to kind of to buy a multi-spectrum force that is shorter range. They're buying lots and lots of type 056 frigate and patrol craft, corvette type warships, and as well as larger destroyer-type warships. Then you go to Russia, and for reasons of its industrial capacity, it's really emphasized a lot more the smaller ships. And so other navies are seeing that. It's very difficult to man and equip very, very large ships, but a lot of these smaller navies and even the larger ones can operate fleets of corvettes such as the Buyan-M, that carries quite a punch, and the Russians have fitted them with land attack missiles, and we see them used against insurgent forces in Syria, and we've seen a lot of stuff like that. So I think that's really where a lot of these navies are going to be going, to the smaller ships. They've historically been easier to operate. They're smaller. They can dock at more places. The downside, of course, is logistics-wise and range-wise, they're shorter. But if you can arm them, the range is shorter, but you can arm them with pretty powerful weapons, as we've seen the Russians do. Now, the downside, of course, of that is also that they can't carry as many weapons as comparable Western warships. So you know, if you compare this to a destroyer or a cruiser in the U.S. fleet, or, you know, a British Type 45 destroyer, the numbers are going to be far less, and they're going to run out of weapons a lot quicker. But I think they're not looking for longevity on these warships in battle. They're looking to be able to take out ships and as many as they can. And I think that's and that's what they're doing. I mean, that's what they're able to do, but they can also take out land targets. So they add a lot of flexibility to smaller fleets.
One of the things I've been looking at is that, and I know Sal's interested in this, but anti-submarine warfare kind of fell off the table for both the U.S. Navy and I think the rest of the world for a while. But now we seem to be running around trying to reassemble the band and get back to being good at it. What's happening in the ASW world?
It's really amazing because it was such a core strength of the U.S. Navy and NATO during the Cold War. And it was really something that was a capability that there was just, I mean, it was unchallenged in its ability to hunt submarines, and they were very, very good at it. That capability really atrophied at the end of the Cold War. It just seemed very unlikely to a lot of planners that it was going to be needed. And I think that because of that, there was such a lack of investment in it, lack of investment in training, lack of investment in equipping the force. And you see countries like the United Kingdom, which actually got rid of its maritime patrol force. Its fleet of Nimrod aircraft was retired without replacement, and suddenly it finds itself without an airborne maritime patrol aircraft, and it has to rely on the U.S. and France to help track submarines that enter into its waters as a result. And just recently, the U.K. has finally accepted this as a shortfall and probably a mistake that they made, and they have signed on for the purchase of P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft. And I think that's going to make a very big difference. It's a little late, but hopefully they'll be able to come on board as soon as possible, because I think it's just one of those requirements you can't do without, because maritime patrol is so, so important in terms of fighting submarines, of course, but also in terms of scanning for ships, doing search and rescue. I mean, it's got incredibly long legs, these aircraft, and they have tremendous numbers of sensors, and they really can contribute to practically any naval mission. And it's amazing to me that would have been a decision to cancel that. I understand that they had sacrifices to make, but it is amazing that they decided to make them with the Nimrod aircraft. And I think, you know, shifting subject a little about some of the types of new technology that's just coming on board. We were talking about that the U.S. is now playing catch-up. One of the newest weapons entering into the arsenal that I think is really going to be have a profound impact is the SM-6 surface-to-air missile. And I think this really shouldn't be overlooked, because it has so much potential. Now, the SM-6, of course, is a very, very long-range weapon, and it's going to be fitted in, and it's being fitted in our Aegis cruisers and destroyers. And it's going to supplement the SM-2 and SM-3 missiles that are already there. Now, the benefits of SM-6 is that it has tremendous range, but recently it was also unveiled that it is able to engage anti-ship ships. So what you're talking about now is that an SM-6, a ship equipped with an SM-6, is able to be fitted with long-range missiles that are able to take out aircraft targets in excess of 200 miles and 200 nautical miles. So, and then if you're talking about it against ships, they don't carry that large of a warhead, but their speed is so fast that during tests, it was able to one of these weapons was able to take out a Perry-class frigate in tests, and it was amazing. And add to that the capability for cooperative engagement, which means that other platforms and sensors such as an E-2D Hawkeye can get the data and guide data on a target to the SM-6. through the cooperative engagement system. This opens up such an amazing net, because what it does is it allows sensors, this cooperative engagement capability allows allied forces, U.S. forces to begin with, and hopefully as allied forces get into it and get tied into this, our forces, our allies can all be tied in and engage so that the best targets can be used, the best platforms can be used against the best targets, and we can really use our force optimally. Of course, this costs a lot of money, and it raises one big challenge, which is data links. That's a major capability, and we need to really make sure, I think, looking to the future, that our data links are secure, because if they're not, think of the vulnerabilities we're going to have. And if history has taught us anything in the past few years, it's that anything seems to be hackable. So I really hope and think that they are, but I think it's very, very important that we pay attention to these data links and to the cyber realm, because it may not seem naval-focused, but it definitely is.
Yeah, it doesn't take much from a software point of view to make something useless. And I'm glad that you brought up the SM6, because I agree with you. That's one of the under-discussed, kind of neat little capabilities that we're bringing with the SM6 that we lost when we got rid of the SM1, which is that our anti-surface capability. And with modern ships, relatively unarmored and thin-skinned, you don't need a big, hulking, you know, Soviet-sized anti-ship cruise missile to get an effective mission kill out of these things. An SM-6 burning at you, even if the warhead doesn't go, is just an impressive capability. It'll be interesting to see how they develop that as time goes forward.
Yeah, and think of the potential that you get with, imagine if you can then, you know, all of a sudden the idea of like the Arsenal ship kind of comes back, which is, you can have these Tomahawk anti-ship missiles, Tomahawk land attack missiles, and you can fit with SM-6. So they even have a capability to operate. They have a capability for terminal ballistic missile defense, and that adds another dimension. Now, of course, with any of these weapons, the downside is going to be cost, and these are very, very expensive weapons. And because of that, you're only going to be able to build so many of them. But I'll tell you, that to me is the biggest challenge right now that we face in the conventional realm against countries like Russia or China, is that in addition to cyber and things like that, we also face the issue of they can make missiles quickly and inexpensively. And our platforms and our weapons are expensive, and we can only put so many of them on each warship. So in the potential conflict, you run the risk of potentially our weapons and platforms running out of weapons before the enemy, a potential enemy, would run out of offensive missiles. The solution to that, we're still a few years away, but that's directed energy. Laser-type weapons, if you can get directed energy, if you can figure that solution out and solve it, all of a sudden you've change the dynamics so that that it's really the holy grail of weapon systems, because you're not going to be running out of ammunition and you're able to handle large numbers of attacks from anti-ship missiles, ballistic missiles, things like that. Once that happens, then I think that will be a tremendous step up for the West and a tremendous challenge for countries like Russia and China, which have invested so heavily in manufacturing a missile threat for anti-access. So I think that's one of the big ways to watch.
So would you, when you're looking at all these hypersonic missiles, which people keep raising, I mean, I think the Indians have the BrahMos or whatever it is, and that they're working with the Russians on that, and the Chinese have something, or purport to have something. The best defense against that, and from your view, I gather, is this directed energy type weapon?
Well, the best defense is being able to kill it before it gets to your area, whether it's soft kill through electronics or hard kill through, you know, taking it out before it gets there. But somewhere in the kill chain, you know, I mean, whether it's blinding it or doing decoying it, that's always the best way if you can do that, because you don't even waste a weapon on it then. But if it does come and does get through, then – the final step would be that directed energy. And if you can do that directed energy, you're not going to face the kind of ammunition shortages and reloading issues that you would face that we face today. And that's one of the biggest challenges: is what do you do when our missiles cost many times more than enemy missiles, and their potential to build them is so much quicker. That's a major challenge, because in that situation, you're faced with a war of attrition, and the war of attrition is not in our favor unless you can hit so hard and so fast that you take out their ability to do that. And so that's right now what we have to do, is kick the door in so hard that it can't be, that they aren't able to do that, or the threat of that, or keep them out of range. So, one of the answers, of course, is stealth, and I think Joint Strike Fighter is going to be a very big factor in being able to ensure the ability to kind of kick the door down when we're dealing with enemy threats and things like that, to take out their launchers, take out that kind of stuff. But, there's so many things here. These are just kind of ideas that people have had little by little in the backs of their mind for generations, and we're starting to see these ideas now finally come to fruition. I think we're possibly a decade away from having directed energy weapons, real directed energy weapons, in addition to things like the laser weapon that was fitted on the Ponce for small boats and things like that. I mean, we're really starting to see this, so it's pretty profound, but we're not working in a vacuum, and our potential adversaries are working hard to keep up as well. Things like hypersonics face are tremendous threats.
And, for a while, even if we get this new technology, there'll be, just a few of them, almost bespoke units. It can take a long time before you get an entire fleet in there. And I thought one of the more interesting developments is, for a while, when it came to big ships, it was pretty much the U.S. Navy. And we saw in the last few months, what I find is a kind of a neat little turnover is, after 60 years of service, the last big gun cruiser out there, the former Dutch, now Peruvian cruiser Admiral Grau, was decommissioned. But then we also saw the Chinese Type 55 that they call a destroyer, but it's longer, has more displacement, and almost as many VLSLs as the U.S. Ticonderoga. And they're beginning serial production of the Type 55, which is that high-end service combatant. What are some of your thoughts on the Type 55?
Yeah, I think that the Chinese are in a position where they don't completely have to compromise on what they build. So they can build a fleet of all different sorts and all different types of weapon systems, ranging from the very smallest and capable ships like the Type 056 to, like I said, like you were saying, these Type 055s and the now they're aircraft carriers. So the big question, they look very, very good and very powerful. The big question is they're untested. And we've seen when we went to fight in Vietnam how challenging untested technology can be. And we faced tremendous challenges when we sent the F-4 Phantom, for instance, to fight against MiGs, and we had not trained our pilots for dogfighting. We had assumed that they would be beyond visual range fights, and so the F-4 Phantom, of course, was not fitted with a gun. And they got to Vietnam, and in many cases they needed visual identification, and they were fighting maneuverable jets like the MiG-21, which had guns and short-range missiles, and by the time the F-4 Phantom got there, they at times were outclassed, not by higher technology, but in fact by lower technology. And so I kind of have this way of thinking that for every Maginot line where someone says we didn't pay attention to fast enough to new technology enough, there's also an example of an F-4 Phantom without a gun. We need to find the right kind of mix, the right compromise between jumping to next generation and keeping what works. And so I think the Chinese, though, are in a different situation because they're funding so much for their Navy that they are able to, at this stage at least, build a wide assortment of vessels. It's not yet the size of the U.S. Navy in terms of power and capability, but they're trying to get there. And I see, in my guess, kind of an internal argument that they're faced with. Do they build what's best for them in terms of anti-access, what's kind of the most powerful type of military that they might need, or do they build kind of what the U.S. Navy does, a Navy in terms of power projection and prestige? Now, my guess is that from a practical standpoint, their anti-access capabilities will be more useful for them. But I think when they look at the U.S., they see aircraft carriers, they see naval aviation, and they see these kind of things that they feel bring prestige, and, of course, cruisers and destroyers. And so that's where I think the Type 55 comes in, is that it's a tremendous asset for their fleet, but I think it's also a kind of, you know, stake in the ground saying, this is what we can do, we are powerful, and you know, I think it's kind of a, we're able to do this too kind of thing. So whether or not it's the most useful for them, it's going to be seen. But they're certainly doing it, I think, as a power projection and kind of an image relations kind of thing, a public relations kind of thing, to, as a prestige, keeping up with the Joneses, if you will, type of asset. Because power projection has not in the past been one of their goals and one of their strengths, yet they seem to be doing that. So now they seem to be building in a way that it appears to me they're a little conflicted in what their goals are. And I'm sure that's what they're dealing with. I think they are conflicted. Should they take on more of an offensive role? Should they take on more power projection? But, of course, the way their country is geographically, it may not be the wisest asset for them. So it'll be interesting to wait and see what happens with the Chinese Navy, because it does have these have money, and you know, with financing comes all these opportunities. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah, I have the same opinion that you do, that they're conflicted. In fact, I was going to ask you the question you already answered, which had to do with what in the world are they thinking? I mean, why build a huge aircraft carrier if your goal is regional supremacy and you've got access already? One of the questions I have that has to do with our amphibious force and I know other countries are starting to build these bigger deck amphibious LHA type platforms. What is the role of the amphibious force now? Is there a reason for us to have such a large, rather expensive force of these things?
I think that you could have made the argument that the amphibious assault was passé maybe 10 to 15 years ago. But I think now when you look at the South China Sea and, you know, you look at the East China Sea, you see more than ever that these ships are needed. And besides the fact of humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, their usefulness for that during peacetime operations and showing the flag, they're tremendously large, impressive warships, and they also are in some ways less expensive because the steel is not such the steel is not the expensive part of a warship, you could argue. It's the electronics and the software and the people. And so when you have these very, very big ships, you can they can be operated in some ways by smaller navies. One of the major players in amphibious ships is the Netherlands. They have you know, they're Carol Dorman class, and they have quite a few amphibious ships. You see Turkey now building a very large amphibious ship. Australia has invested in them because they're very, very useful for peacetime operations, but they can also get where they need to. They're most useful, I think, in terms of low-end all the way up to kind of high mid-level combat operations. Look at the Falklands. If the British did not have an amphibious fleet, they could not have successfully completed the Falklands operations and reseized the Falklands Islands. They couldn't do that without an amphibious fleet. When you look at all these little places in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, that are contested, how do you think you're going to be able to get forces to them? powerful forces, you know, forces with heavy armor, forces with adequate for adequate supplies and resupplies. It's going to be done through amphibious assaults in many ways. And one of the newest, most powerful platforms that people sometimes overlook are the expeditionary sea base concept. You see it now. The third element of the class, the Lewis Puller, just recently entered service. These are really interesting concepts because in the past, if you remember, during the first Gulf War, we had to have perfect port facilities to bring all these heavy lift ships in. You see the row-row ships, the roll-on, roll-off, all these kind of platforms that need to have wonderful port facilities. Well, as you know, in humanitarian assistance, disaster release operations, as well as in combat operations, great port facilities may not exist. They may have been demolished. They may be at risk, or they may have been captured. And so what these expeditionary sea bases and the Montford Point, what they allow is these roll-on, roll-off cargo ships and the maritime preposition ships. In the past, they needed a port. Well, now they can pull up to these expeditionary sea bases and transfer their cargo to LCACs. Isn't this fascinating? Because now the LCACs, the landing craft air cushions, can then move the stuff right to the beach and unload. And you can get your heavy reinforcements in that way without the kind of port facilities that might have been required in previous conflicts. So that's what one of the things I think is so remarkable about this is sometimes the military is kind of criticized for not being innovative. But I think the example of the expeditionary sea base is, in my mind, is very adaptive. It's looking at a gap and looking at a problem, and they took a commercial ship and they used that as the base hull, and they built the Montford Point and Lewis Puller and another sister, and other ones are coming into service. So we're seeing that. And what's sometimes most interesting is when you look at a lot of these designs that are kind of considered, that we consider successful or sometimes not even sure about, and you look at what the Chinese are doing, they're looking at that and saying, that's a good idea, we're going to build them ourselves. And the Chinese are doing just that. They don't necessarily do that with a littoral combat ship, the LCS, but you see them doing it with some of the naval assets that they think start looking like a good idea. And I think that ESB, the Expeditionary Sea Base, is a good example of using our forces to the best capability to be able to transfer our maritime preposition ships and our cargo ships right to the beach when we need to. That's just something that we couldn't do before.
Yeah, I share your perplexed nature towards that argument. And you see it every few generations where there's a moment in time, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, where you could make the argument that you'll never see amphibious operations ever again. But that time passes real fast. There's thousands of years of military experience tells you you're going to need to move forces in an opposed landing. And I think we're almost going to reach a renaissance with amphibious capable ships for a few reasons. Part of that is, like you mentioned, these big port facilities, these top shelf port facilities. Nothing is more fixed or fragile than a commercial port facility. And what we've seen ashore the last decade and a half plus is fairly inexpensively, you can asymmetrically attack and make useless, fixed, exquisitely designed systems. So you're going to, if you still need to be able to project power ashore, and if somebody has sunk a tramp streamer that's going to take care of your port access for a couple of months, you've got to do it some other way. And a lot of the navies are taking these large deck amphibs and are really, they're not one-trick ponies. You can do lots of things, and we've seen disaster relief and other things. And I wanted to talk about one of the more interesting developments that has some people concerned, some people interested, and some people like myself are kind of laughing at the excuses. But the Japanese helicopter carriers, and they've made the press recently showing the flag a bit. The Koreans have what we would call a large deck amphib as well. Talk a little bit about some of the Japanese developments with what were once just helicopter carrying destroyers on the stern. Now they have a nice little carrier to work with, if they wanted to call it that.
Exactly. For political reasons, they don't want to call, the Japanese does not want to call these platforms, these very, very large, you know, 20,000-ton vessels, aircraft carriers, which in essence they are. They have aircraft elevators and helicopter landing spots, and they're quite large. But for political reasons, they're instead called helicopter-carrying destroyers. Their weapons fits are not really comparable to what we would consider a destroyer. They're really armed only with self-defense weapons frequently. But their real weapon is the aircraft and the helicopters and the ability to transport troops. And, you know, when you look at this, you can start putting MV-22s on them. And the Japanese, one of the most interesting things is they're actually building a Marine Corps now, and they have established one, and they're buying amphibious AAVs, amphibious assault vehicles, and all types of stuff, basing it on the U.S. Marine Corps, because they realize that this is a real vulnerability for them when you look at the contested areas in the South China Sea. The same with Korea. When you look at this, Koreans are seeing that they have contested islands, and the way you reinforce them, the way you land on them, or I use this expression a lot, but kick down the door to get in, is with these amphibious assault ships, because we see that aircraft can only carry so much, and they're very useful, but the aircraft are just not going to be able to carry things like tanks in. And there are certain times where you want to have be able to transport the armor. You want to be able to do that. Now, aircraft are much more flexible, and they're going to have range, and they're going to be able to fly in deeper than just the beach. So those are benefits. But these aircraft, especially ones, these platforms, especially ones that have loading docks and floodable docks, are able to kind of use this to the best of their advantage. And we're seeing it with aircraft, especially now on the, you know, the 20,000-ton helicopter destroyers, the Hyuga class, the Issei that the Japanese are using. Those are about 18,000 tons. And then, of course, they built the Type 22, the larger ones of those. So we're seeing the Japanese have a very, very capable fleet. I think they're often overlooked because of the nature of their defensive nature of their force, the Maritime Self-Defense Force. But their diesel submarines are among the best in the world, the Iosu class. They're very, very good, and they're building more of them. The Suryu class is now their newest submarine, and they were looked at by Australia. They were looked at by a lot of things, a lot of countries, and they have the potential for export. Of course, there's a lot of constitutional issues to have to deal with. But those Soryu classes, their improved version of the I have to figure out how to pronounce it by Ayasashio, I guess. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it. But the Soryu are the most advanced. They started entering service in about 2009, 2010, and they're still joining the fleet. And they have Stirling Air Independent Propulsion capability. They're really, really good systems. Plus, the Japanese are one of the firmest believers in Aegis. They are big. They've invested very heavily in their Atago class, their Kongo class, and they're building more and more of these. So we're seeing very heavy investment, and they're really well integrated in with the U.S. Navy, as anyone who's had experience with the navies sees, even more so than in some ways some of our NATO navies and NATO allies. So, yeah, absolutely, I think. And we're seeing that with Korea also. Korea is also a very big investor now in Aegis technology, as well as big deck amphibs. The big question is whether they start to operate F-35s off them, like our Marine Corps.
Well, speaking of diesel submarines or air independent submarines, you know, the debate always goes on. In the U.S., should we stop building the, as Sal calls them, the Tiffany class nuke boats and develop a lot more smaller but less expensive mindset, is that a good idea for the U.S. Navy, or are those mostly suitable for regional operations and not the international operations we engage in?
So my gut feel on a lot of this stuff is for the U.S., and I know a lot of my colleagues would disagree with me, but for the U.S., I really do think that nuclear capable is where you're going to need to be, because we're very rarely going to have short-range submarine operations, and you want to get there unseen and unheard, and only really nuclear submarines can do that quickly. Now, other NATO navies, like the Netherlands, like Italy and other NATO navies, have invested very, very heavily in diesels, and they form a very important part of NATO, and there are times when we use them, like, interestingly, the Dutch submarines were said to be operating in support of the operations against Somali pirates, which is kind of a unique use of submarine operations. But I think that we're seeing that diesels can be used, but it's an area where my opinion is that I don't think it's necessarily a best investment for the U.S. What I think one of the things that the U.S. I encourage and I think is good is when we find a system that works, like the Virginias, I think it's very good to continue building them and investing in them like we did with the Nimitz-class aircraft carriers. The Ticonderoga cruisers, the Arleigh Burke destroyers. I feel that when we find something that works, it's great to invest in them, because one of the challenges of new technology, it's very important to find a balance, but so much money is often spent that what I've seen happen is they have something that they've considered too gold-plated, like the Seawolf submarine. Then what happens is when they say this is too expensive, they don't get the benefit of mass production in the same way that they would for buying, not that they're mass produced anyway, but that you'd have buying in bulk, essentially. And then what happens is they spend lots of money on research and development to develop something that's less effective and sometimes winds up with all the developmental costs being more expensive or as expensive, yet is less capable. And then add to that all these developmental costs, the new technology, and you wind up paying more for something that's less. And sometimes I feel like once we have a system that works, I think that it's important to look into that and invest in it to get everything that we can out of it, while also having some ability to invest in smaller technology. I think it's very sad that we stopped production of the F-22, for instance, with the Air Force side of things, because they said we're not using them to the degree we should in Afghanistan, let's say, but that's overlooking the point, because we're not only going to fight in Afghanistan, and we have to be ready to fight in more places than Afghanistan. We have to really keep a balanced, technologically advanced force, and I feel like we made a lot of the same mistakes we made during Vietnam and after Vietnam, which was heavily investing in counterinsurgency operations and all this type of stuff at the expense of the more conventional weapons that we had to go back to after the end of Vietnam War. And I think we're having to go back to that now after the global war on terror and the war against in Iraq and Afghanistan. So to make a long – my point, to kind of make it a little longer even, but – it's just to say, I think we're going to be seeing a renaissance of the military as they look at more conventional threats, and I think we're starting to see that. And nuclear submarines are a big part of that.
Well, one of the conventional threats that has gotten the land side of the house's attention has been, Russia's slow and steady walk back onto the international stage, and the experience a lot of our advisors have seen in eastern Ukraine. And especially if those nations with the limited military budgets that were helping us out in Afghanistan and to a lesser extent Iraq, a lot of the navies in NATO's Baltic periphery and with the former Warsaw Pact and Soviet Union republics that have come on board NATO, that was kind of neglected. At the end of the Cold War, the Danes had their little Type 206 submarines that they used to guard the gates of the Baltic. What have you seen from our NATO allies in their response to Russia's slow return to a combat capability at sea in the Baltic?
Yes, unfortunately, the their NATO response has been slower than the Russian return. So what I see is that the Russians are returning to the region in strength faster than NATO is able to respond. And I think Russia and in Europe and Asia in the East is aware that there is kind of this window. Before NATO and before the U.S. and our allies in Asia are able to add that conventional threat back, add that conventional kind of stopping power, they're going to have an advantage. And I think that right now NATO has cut itself so closely to the bone and emphasized patrolling and small low threat type environments, because that's what they were buying. That's what they were investing in at the end of the Cold War and in the early 2000s. That's where their money went. And now those platforms are coming into being. And we're seeing them enter the fleet now. And they're quickly having to be rearmored and re-upped increased. And so we're seeing that problem. Now, to deal with that, they're having to bring back their old playbooks. I saw that Sweden, for instance, is – while not a NATO ally, is very closely integrated in that region with the NATO alliance in terms of their coordination and communication and just their training and things. While not officially, of course, a member of NATO, but the Swedes are bringing people from the Cold War who did certain missions, bringing them back, asking them how they did it. And there's a lot of we're seeing a lot of things like that, where the capability that was lost is now being quickly picked up to be regained, and they're working as hard as they can. But of course, ships can't be built overnight. Now, one real strength that we're seeing, the British Queen Elizabeth class aircraft carriers are now coming to fruition. They're coming to service. They're going to be in service within 5 years, and that was a tremendous sacrifice on behalf of the British to get those in service. Their active duty forces, their navies, are across the spectrum, made incredible sacrifices to make sure that they kept that capability. You could argue whether or not they built the right platforms or they built the right, bought the right aircraft to go with them, but I think the fact that they have them now and the fact that we're going to have two more big deck aircraft carriers in NATO that can help in some ways relieve a U.S. presence. Think of in the Persian Gulf, if a U.S. aircraft carrier is needed somewhere else, a British now aircraft carrier in a few years will be able to plug that gap with F-35B, you know, V-STOL joint strike fighters and its own version of airborne early warning AWACS aircraft. You know, so that kind of thing is that's a lesson the British learned in the Falklands, how important aircraft carriers are, aircraft and fixed-wing platforms. And they are taking that was something that atrophied at the end of the Cold War, after the Cold War, and they're now bringing that up. So there are good signs. We're seeing this as Tomahawk gets an anti-ship capability, as SM-6 comes into being, as Joint Strike Fighter enters the fleet. We are seeing this capability, but it's not happening fast enough. There's not enough money to go around, of course, and the Russians and the Chinese and any potential adversaries, Iran, North Korea, they've had over a decade to kind of get the jump on all this stuff. So it's been a lot. They've invested heavily while we have not in that area, and we're just catching up. All of NATO, all of us are in the West.
Is there hope for us in using unmanned technology, the drones and the air subsurface and surface type assets?
Yes, absolutely. I think it plays to one of our strengths, which is we don't have as many people, but we have technology. And so one of the strengths of that, of course, the weakness that we always have to be careful of is the cyber, as we discussed, the data links and such. Plus, you want to make sure your unmanned systems don't get so expensive that you can't risk them either. You know, that's a definite challenge.
And close to home, what are the things I wanted to touch in, mostly because I hope they change their paint scheme. I never liked the color of their ships, but the Canadians at last are looking at recapitalizing their surface fleet. What are some of your thoughts on the Canadian developments, and do you have an idea how many units they might wind up with all said and done?
Well, that's a good question. The Canadians really have, it's been very, very important for them to invest in this. They're really behind the power curve on a lot of this stuff. It's really tough to guess what they'll end up with. You know, that's a really tough guess, but it's really important for their fleet. They're in many ways, you could argue, a maritime nation as well. And I think that, so their fleet, you know, is going to be, they're getting their Victoria-class submarines fully operational, you know, construction on the Coast Guard offshore fisheries, science vessels, stuff like that, the Queenstown joint support ships, all that stuff, getting their Halifax frigate and Iroquois-class replacements. Those are really important. So they're looking for up to 15 of those multi-role warships they're looking at that in the mid-2020s. Hopefully they'll get there. I don't think they're going to be that many, but we'll see. But one of the bright spots for them happened in April of 2016, when one of their frigates, Vancouver, fired a Harpoon Block 2 missile against a land target. It shows they're trying to adapt. I mean, here they have a smaller navy, but they're being able to use their harpoons in different ways and testing it against land targets. So that's a plus. It shows they're making an effort there. I think that's important.
Eric, we've used up a little over an hour of your time, I think, and I want to thank you for coming on the show. Before we let you go, though, what are you working on? When we see a new edition of Combat Fleets of the World, you know, what would you like to our listeners look forward to?
Well, of course, a new edition is always in the back of my mind, and that will be up to the publisher. So hopefully sometime soon. I'm always kind of ready and waiting, but at the same time dreading the next one. So it is something that's we're aware of. I think it's going to be digital if it goes, is what they're saying, and hopefully it will soon. Other than that, I just turned in my new monthly column, January 2018 monthly column today. I just hit send before before joining you on the air here, and I'll be working on February, and next is my World Navy's in review for March. So it's going to be a busy time, as the new year always is, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, again, I'd like to join in and saying thank you for joining us today. I've greatly enjoyed the hour, and we look forward to seeing all your work in the busy year.
Thank you. Always glad to be here.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Bye.
Hoping you're the same.